Topic number 2. Late last month, on the evening of August 30th, another of our never-ending crises began. News wires crackled with ominous words from the Idaho home of Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Frank Church. He was quoted as saying that American intelligence had confirmed the presence of Russian combat troops in Cuba, and breaking with his past behavior, he surprised everyone. He demanded the immediate withdrawal of all Russian combat troops from Cuba. What's going on, my friends, is another skirmish, a major one, between the Bolsheviks and the Christian rulers of Russia. The Bolsheviks in our government here in America are following a strategy now which has important similarities to their Guyana strategy of last November 1978. There's not enough time for me to review all the details of what happened then. For those details you may want to refresh your memory by listening again to AUDIO LETTER 40. But for now, let me just remind you that last November the Bolsheviks used tensions over Cuba as a part of a larger strategy. The same thing is happening again now, but this time there is an important difference. Using their robotoids, the Russians are succeeding so far in staying one step ahead of the Bolsheviks. Last time the real target was not Cuba, but the secret Russian missile base in Guyana. This time the primary target again is not Cuba, but the SALT II Treaty. And yet, just as before, the Russians do not dare lower their guard around Cuba or anywhere else, because the Bolsheviks here will lash out wherever they can find an opening, anywhere in the world. Last time, the artificial Bolshevik crisis over Cuba was built around MiG-23s. This time it is Russian ground combat troops. 3,000 Russian troops could no more attack the United States from Cuba today than the MiG-23s could have attacked last year. What's more, the Bolsheviks here are using old information about Russian troops now, just as they used old information about MiG-23s last year. The alleged spy satellite pictures of Russian troops in Cuba were not obtained last month as claimed. Regardless of what Robotoid Carter says tomorrow night on television, the pictures are actually almost 2 years old, obtained in late 1977. 2 years ago this month, on September 27, 1977, the United States lost the most decisive battle of the 20th century to Russia. It was history's first space battle, the Battle of the Harvest Moon. I reported it that month in AUDIO LETTER 26, but it has never been reported to the public officially. Following that battle, the United States and Russia were on the brink of war. The Russians were pressuring our own rulers behind the scenes to abandon their plans for conquest by nuclear war. America's step-by-step surrender by unilateral disarmament under SALT II was demanded by the Russians. Meanwhile, Russia's newly operational Cosmos interceptors had begun systematically destroying America's space fleet of spy satellites. The Cosmos interceptors, which are manned and armed with particle beam weapons, were seeking out and blasting our spy satellites one by one. The United States has no defense against the Cosmos interceptors, but the process of eliminating all our spy satellites was a gradual one, taking several months to complete. By April 1978 they were all gone, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 33. But in the meantime, the CIA turned on all of our spy satellites. The idea was to gather as much information as possible worldwide before they were destroyed. Normally, they are only turned on selectively in order to extend their operating life, but with Russian Cosmos interceptors blasting them into fireballs, one after another, that no longer mattered. One of the things picked up by the satellites in their dying days late 1977 were Russian maneuvers in Cuba. The maneuvers were taking place in brigade strength, which was puzzling. The Russian Army normally does not use the brigade as a unit of organization. It only made sense later on when it was learned that Soviet troops, mostly from Asia, were being infiltrated into Canada and Mexico. This is in preparation for possible invasion of the United States across our northern and southern borders, as I reported long ago in AUDIO LETTER No. 32. The troops are entering Canada through the province of Quebec as part of an arrangement, a secret arrangement, between Russia and France. In Mexico, they are entering through the Yucatan Peninsula. French influence is also great in Mexico, although this is less well known here in the United States. Cuba is the key way station for the troops, whether headed for Canada or Mexico. In AUDIO LETTER No. 32, I explained the manner in which the Russian troops are remaining dispersed and therefore undetected in Canada and Mexico. But when and if the order to invade the United States is given, they are to form up quickly into organized fighting forces. In planning this strategy, the Russian generals concluded that the optimum organizational unit would be the brigade, and so when the troops arrive in Cuba, they are trained in brigade-sized maneuvers. Then they disband and are injected into Quebec and the Yucatan Peninsula. So the Bolsheviks here in the government, in charging that there is a brigade of Russian troops in Cuba, are telling such a small fragment of the truth that it amounts to a lie. They dare not tell the whole truth, because that would open up questions about our non-existent spy satellites. Even so, the Bolsheviks have calculated cleverly. The Russians have no way in which they can defend themselves by explaining what is really going on, because no one would understand. So it is once again a battle of maneuver and intrigue. My friends, when the SALT II Treaty was signed in Vienna 3 months ago, I alerted you to be on the lookout for certain things. At that time there was great publicity that SALT II was in trouble in the Senate, but as I told you then in AUDIO LETTER No. 47, the Russians were replacing key Bolshevik agents in the Senate with their own robotoids. As a result, I was able to tell you to watch for opposition to SALT II to gradually fade away, and through the rest of the summer that is exactly what was happening. SALT II prospects were getting better by the day. Even so, I also cautioned in AUDIO LETTER No. 47 that, quote, "there remains a slim chance that the Bolsheviks will somehow find a way to upset SALT II," unquote. And also, quote, "the ratification of SALT II could be the litmus test that will decide between peace and war for America and Russia," unquote. These are the stakes in the struggle now over Russian troops in Cuba. It began in mid-July. Bolshevik sources began feeding carefully fabricated tips about Russian troops in Cuba to Florida Senator Richard Stone. Stone then brought it up during the SALT II hearings by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. During testimony by the Secretary of Defense, robotoid Harold Brown, Stone unexpectedly asked about a Soviet combat brigade in Cuba. Robotoid Brown had not yet been programmed for that question and was puzzled. But Robotoid Senator Frank Church, the chairman of the committee, jumped into the discussion. Between them, the two Russian Robotoids, Brown and Church, defused the issue temporarily. Robotoid Brown authorized Robotoid Church to issue a comforting statement to the press. It denied that Cuba harbored a Russian military presence other than advisors. But now the Russians knew what the Bolsheviks were going to use for their manufactured anti-SALT II crisis. They knew they could not stop the Bolsheviks from somehow breaking it into the open, so they played for time. Every additional day made the SALT II Treaty just a little more secure. Meanwhile, using their robotoids in key positions, the Russians stayed alert for the next Bolshevik move. In mid-August, the Russian KGB learned about the ploy being cooked up by the Bolsheviks within the CIA. The robotoid replacement for CIA Director Stansfield Turner had learned about the intended use of the 2-year-old satellite pictures of Russian troops in Cuba. The Russians braced themselves. They also programmed the Frank Church robotoid to take the initiative on Cuba the moment he was told anything about alleged recent satellite pictures of Cuba. On August 30, the Church robotoid was among those who were informed about the supposedly new satellite pictures. As programmed, he swung into action immediately. In Idaho for the Labor Day recess, the Church robotoid summoned reporters for a news conference. There he made the announcement and hard-line statements which launched the present crisis. By taking such a hard-line position, the Church robotoid surprised everyone. Fellow senators raised their eyebrows in astonishment, and so did many members of the press. But it was a clever and unexpected move by the Russians, because in this way the Russians took the ball away from the Bolsheviks. Senator Stone, who had started the whole thing, was left no room to be more hawkish than Church. And since Church is the chairman of the committee while Stone is only a member, everyone promptly forgot about Stone. Now when the conditions are right, Robotoid Church will be in command of the situation. Having been the hardest of the hardliners, he will have credibility if he later announces, "I am satisfied. The Cuban situation is now resolved, so let us proceed with SALT II." That is the outcome which the Russians are striving for. Meanwhile, the Russians are using their robotoids in the Senate to delay a vote on SALT II. This is a move to save the treaty, which would be defeated if a vote were taken right now. Meanwhile, very dangerous and intricate maneuverings are continuing on both sides. The Russians are still having difficulties with their robotoids and are having to introduce them more slowly than planned. At the same time, the Bolsheviks are beginning to regroup and regain some strength. As a result, the risk of nuclear war is beginning to rise again. The danger is still far less than it was at this time last year, but it is growing. In fact, as of this moment, a military war of nerves is secretly in progress between Russia and the United States. 3 nights ago, the National Security Council held one meeting after another in this war of nerves. The meetings began the evening of September 27, the second anniversary of the Battle of the Harvest Moon, and they continued long through the night. Russian robotoids in the Council were working overtime to keep the lid on the situation. Meanwhile, my friends, there are presently about 500 Russian submarines in positions for possible attack around the United States. About 200 are lined up along our east coast, while 150 are stationed along the west coast, and roughly the same number along our Gulf coast. Of course, the Russians do not have to depend on their submarines if they ever decide to actually attack. For 3 years now, Russian short-range underwater launch missiles have been planted within our own territorial waters, and for more than 2 years, Russian hydrogen bombs have been planted at their targets throughout the United States. These range from tiny micro-nukes to giant dam busters. Finally, the Russians also have their space triad of weapons, for which we have no equivalent. One leg of their space triad consists of the Cosmos interceptors, which I referred to earlier. Another leg is on the Moon, where Russian particle beam weapons have been stationed for nearly 2 years. And the third leg is their fleet of Cosmospheres, which are floating high above our cities and military sites. But as of now, the Russians do not wish to attack. Their actual goal is the opposite. It is called deterrence. They are using their submarine deployment to send a message to the Bolsheviks here in America. In particular, the Russian subs are deployed with special emphasis on the southeastern United States, reflecting their concern for Cuba. That emphasis consists of missile submarines known to be armed with neutron warheads. Neutron weapons, my friends, are the most usable of all nuclear weapons because they produce essentially no fallout. So by deploying them, the Russians are warning the Bolsheviks, "If you strike, so will we." Topic number 3. Over the past 2 years or so, I have discussed the struggle within Russia between the Christians and the Bolsheviks since 1917. Current events cannot be understood without knowing about the past 6 decades of struggle for control of the Kremlin. But that struggle, in turn, is part of an even bigger historical picture. What we are seeing today, my friends, is the climax of a war of more than 1,000 years between the two most bitter enemies on earth. It is the war between Russia and the Khazars. The kingdom of the Khazars vanished from the map of the world many centuries ago. Today, many people have never even heard of it. Yet in its day, the Khazar kingdom was a very major power indeed, holding sway over a large empire of subjugated peoples. It had to be reckoned with by the two neighboring superpowers of that day. To the south and west of Khazaria, the Byzantine Empire was in full flower with its Eastern Orthodox Christian civilization. To the southeast, the Khazar kingdom bordered on the expanding Muslim empire of the Arab caliphs. The Khazars influenced the histories of both of these other empires, but far more importantly, the Khazar kingdom occupied what was later to become a southern portion of Russia between the Black and Caspian Seas. As a result, the historical destinies of the Russians and the Khazars became intertwined in ways which have persisted down to the present day. In case you have never heard of the Khazars, I think I should mention where you can look to learn more about them. 3 years ago, in 1976, a book about the Khazars was published by the British writer Arthur Koestler. The book is titled The 13th Tribe, The Khazar Empire and Its Heritage. The American publisher is Random House, New York, New York. History records that the Khazars were derived from a mixture of Mongols, Turks, and Finns. As early as the 3rd century AD, they were identifiable in constant warfare in the areas of Persia and Armenia. Later in the 5th century, the Khazars were among the devastating hordes of Attila the Hun. Around 550 AD, the nomadic Khazars began settling themselves in the area around the northern Caucasus, between the Black and Caspian Seas. The Khazar capital of Itil was established at the mouth of the Volga River, where it emptied into the Caspian in order to control the river traffic. The Khazars then exacted a toll of 10% on any and all cargo which passed Itil on the river. Those who refused were attacked and slaughtered. With their kingdom firmly established in the Caucasus, the Khazars gradually began to create an empire of subjugated peoples. More and more Slavonic tribes, who were peaceful compared to the Khazars, were attacked and conquered. They became parts of the Khazar Empire, required to pay tribute continually to the Khazar kingdom. Tribute by conquered peoples has always been a feature of empires, of course, but not in the fashion of the Khazars. The so-called great empires of the world always gave something in return for the tribute they exacted. Rome, for example, made citizens of those they conquered, and in return for the taxes they levied, they brought civilization, order, and protection against attack from would-be invaders. But not so in the Khazar Empire. The peoples who were subject to the Khazars received only one thing in return for their payments of tribute, and that was a shaky promise. The Khazars would refrain from further attacks and pillage so long as the tributes were paid. The subjects of the Khazar Empire, therefore, were nothing more than the victims of a giant protection racket. The Khazar overlords were therefore resented universally and bitterly throughout their domain, but they were also feared because of the merciless way in which they dealt with anyone who stood up to them. And so the Khazar Empire expanded until it occupied large areas of what is now Russia and southeastern Europe. By the 8th century, the Khazar Empire extended northward to Kiev and westward to include the Magyars, the ancestors of modern Hungary. In about 740 AD, a stunning event took place. The Khazars had been under continual pressure from their Byzantine and Muslim neighbors to adopt either Christianity or Islam, but the Khazar ruler, called the Khagan, had heard of a third religion called Judaism. Apparently for political reasons of independence, the Khagan announced that the Khazars were adopting Judaism as their religion. Overnight, an entirely new group of people, the warlike Khazars, suddenly proclaimed themselves Jews, adoptive Jews. The Khazar kingdom began to be described as the Kingdom of the Jews by historians of that day. Succeeding Khazar rulers took Jewish names, and during the late 9th century the Khazar kingdom became a haven for Jews from other lands. Meanwhile, the brutal Khazar domination over other peoples continued unchanged, but then a new factor appeared on the scene. During the 8th century they came coursing down the great rivers, the Dnieper, the Don, the Volga. They were the eastern branch of the Vikings. They were known as the Varangians or as the Rus. Like other Vikings, the Rus were bold adventurers and fierce fighters, but when they tangled with the Khazars, the Rus often ended up paying tribute like everyone else. In the year 862, a Rus leader named Rurik founded the city of Novgorod, and the Russian nation was born. The Rus Vikings settled among the Slavonic tribes under Khazar domination, and the struggle between Vikings and Khazars changed in character. It became a struggle by the emerging nation of Russia for independence from Khazar oppression. Over a century after the founding of Russia's first city, another momentous event took place. Russia's leader, Prince Vladimir of Kiev, accepted baptism as a Christian in the year 989. He actively promoted Christianity in Russia, and his memory is revered by Russians today as Saint Vladimir. And so, 1,000 years ago, Russia's tradition as a Christian nation began. Vladimir's conversion also brought Russia into alliance with Byzantium. The Byzantine rulers had always feared the Khazars, and the Russians were still struggling to free themselves. And so in the year 1016, combined Russian and Byzantine forces attacked the Khazar kingdom. The Khazar empire was shattered, and the kingdom of the Khazars itself fell into decline. Eventually, most of the Khazar Jews migrated to other areas. Many of them wound up in Eastern Europe, where they mingled and intermarried with other Jews. Like the Semitic Jews some 1,000 years earlier, the Khazar Jews became dispersed. The kingdom of the Khazars was no more. As they moved and lived among the Jewish people, the Khazar Jews passed on a distinct heritage from generation to generation. One element of the Khazar Jew heritage is a militant form of Zionism. In the view of Khazar Jews, the land occupied by ancient Israel is to be retaken not by miracle but by armed force. This is what is meant by Zionism today, and this is the force that created the nation which calls itself Israel today. The other major ingredient of the Khazar Jew heritage is hatred for Christianity and for the Russian people as the champions of the Christian faith. Christianity is viewed as the force which caused the ancient so-called Kingdom of the Jews, the Khazar Kingdom, to collapse. Having once dominated much of what is present-day Russia, the Khazar Jews still want to re-establish that domination, and for a millennium they have been trying continually to do just that. In 1917, the Khazar Jews passed a major milestone toward the creation of their own state in Palestine, as I mentioned last month. That same year they also created the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. There followed a Christian Holocaust, the likes of which the world has never seen. The Khazar Jews were once again in control of Russia after more than 900 years, and they set about the task of destroying Christianity by destroying Christians, over 100 million of them. And at the same time, over 20 million religious Jews also died at the hands of the Khazar Jews. This, my friends, is what the Russian Christians were up against in their 60-year struggle to overthrow the atheistic Bolsheviks. But they finally succeeded in their overthrow program, and now the thousand-year-old war between the Russian Christians and the Khazar Jews is reaching a climax. At stake is not only the future of Russia and of Christianity, but also of the Jewish people as a whole. Last month, on August 19, 1979, Rabbi Joel Teitelbaum died in New York. He died in the morning and was buried the same afternoon. Very short notice, and yet some 100,000 Jewish men arrived in time for the funeral. It is hard to imagine how many more hundreds of thousands could not arrive on such short notice. A month later, on September 18, his followers placed a memorial tribute by way of a paid advertisement in the New York Times, and clearly it spoke for many Jews. Among other things, it said, quote, "He was the undisputed leader of all Jews everywhere who had not been infected by Zionism," unquote. And also, quote, "With a courage all too rare in our time, he called the Zionist state a work of Satan, a sacrilege, and a blasphemy. The shedding of blood for the sake of the Zionist state was abhorrent to him," unquote. Those words, my friends, were spoken by Orthodox Jews mourning for their fallen leader. And the new Christian rulers of Russia would agree, for they too regard the Zionist state of Israel as a counterfeit, a cruel and dangerous hoax for Christian and Jew alike. The Khazar state, called the Kingdom of the Jews 1,000 years ago, was a parasite living on the tribute from conquered peoples. Likewise today, Israel depends for its survival on a never-ending flow of support from outside. Left unchecked, the Russians believe that the Khazar Jews will destroy Christianity by means of Zionism and Russia through Bolshevism. So Russia's Christian rulers are on the offensive against their enemies of 1,000 years, the Khazars. We Americans who call ourselves Christians have not cared enough to open our eyes to try to save our own country or to defend our faith. So now our land has become the battleground of the Christian Russians and their deadly enemies, the Bolsheviks and the Zionists. And like it or not, my friends, we are caught up in this all-out war. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.